To move to the Jackson versus Commonwealth of Virginia case. Council's ready. And Council, would you like to reserve some rebuttal time? Certainly.
Hey, please, court. My name is Vikram Kapil and I represent Franklin Jackson. I have 3 points to ask the court to consider. The defendant of Jackson had to have spoken to the victim in this case directly to give this proposal. Second point, there was no evidence that he had broadcast his proposal to her, although she had overheard the second part of this statement.
Well, counsel, let's back up here just a moment. Perhaps I don't recall the evidence correctly, but didn't her brother testify that, in fact, that it was broadcast directly to her?
Well, that's an interesting point. And what's interesting there is that the victim, the sister, walked to the door, opened the door, and just to quickly go through the evidence in that sense, the defendant said, come to the car. She walked away and she testified, I walked away. In fact, I had my back to him as I was walking away. My brother had come to the door and talked to the defendant, to Jackson. The brother testified that I was sitting in the living room and I heard all this conversation to her. It was a major variation in the evidence.
But if she did hear, and if a reasonable fact finder could conclude that your client knew she could hear, why does it matter that he prefaces it with John instead of her name?
Because the argument we have is that it had to have been made to her. The court made an argument that was saying that he broadcast this, but there was no evidence of the volume or whether he was talking over someone or trying to get around the brother. There was none of that kind of evidence. And also, he said...
I'm talking to you right now.
Sure.
But if I say something to the effect of, and I would like you to address this in rebuttal, or the Commonwealth can address it when it gets to the podium on what page the brother's testimony appears in the appendix. I would like the Commonwealth to do that. I'm talking to you. Everybody would reasonably conclude that I know she can hear me. Why haven't I directed a proposal at her?
And that's what the judge argued, one of the points the court was making with the lunch argument, that
right.
I could be proposing a lunch, but I'm talking to someone else.
Explain to me why that doesn't get there under the statute.
And there's a numerous other interpretation of that particular statement. You have to hear what the context of that statement.
Well, right. But if one of the contexts is what I just theorized, and the fact finder concludes that that's what in fact happened, don't you lose?
We would lose. But the problem is that you have to simply ignore all the other interpretations and not consider it at all. Courts do have that power. They have that discretion. And this court is not going to second guess the court in that situation. But it has to look at the context as a whole. That's why it's very important for the distinction of whether the brother testified, what the brother said, as opposed to what the sister said. The sister was the victim. And interestingly enough, and sort of an aside, the brother, the first time he testifies or the first time he gives any evidence as to what happens is at trial. The sheriff, I think it's in the transcript, the sheriff had not, the investigator had not talked to him up until this point.
Kenneth, you don't dispute that a conviction could be had under the statute with the victim never testifying at all, just the brother testifying what he observed about the conversation.
Let me turn it this way. If there was no intervening person, if the victim was standing there and I say, I want you to come in the car so you can sit on my face, that's clear. But if I say, I want you to come in my car and you walk away, now I'm talking to someone else, I think that it's different.
Well, no, that's not my question. My question is, assume the victim testifies not at all. And only the brother testifies about what he observed and what he believed, about what to whom he believed the comment was directed. That's, if believed, that's sufficient to support a conviction under the statute, isn't it?
If it, it would be sufficient to support the conviction. However, again, you have to look at the context. It's a, this case is more of a physical type thing, really, than anything else. If the brother testifies and the sister does not testify, the victim, and he says she was standing there and I was the eyewitness and I heard it, and he was talking to her directly, then I think your point is absolutely well taken. But if he says, I saw her walking away, but then he was talking to me, then I think that's different. And I think the next case is what we were relying on, or what we rely on to try to show that the proposal has to be made to the victim. And it has to be the intent of the defendant to make it to that victim. And what the sister says is that she testified, her testimony on, I think on the, I would say a transcript page 35 and 36. She says, I want that I want your sister to sit on my face. So again, he's not talking to her in the sense, he's talking to him. The judge then said, well then that's was one way I can find him guilty. The second way I can find him guilty is that if Jackson made a proposal, come to the car. But then what he tells the brother is the intent. I can link the two. And I argue to the judge that that doesn't work. That can't work either. Because it's more likely than not the Jackson is responding to something the brother is saying. I mean, if Jackson had said to the brother, I just wanted her to have an apple. I suppose there's no crime because it's not a sexual reference. But if he says it in a sarcastic way, if he says it in a angry way, if he says it in some way in which is a joking way, and in fact this person was a family friend of this group of people. So.
But all of those things as to whether it was a joke or sarcastic or what have you, wouldn't that be for the trier of fact to determine?
It would be for the trier of fact to determine, and again, you know, it, Mr. Jackson has a tough standard to try to overcome. But as this court, as the Supreme Court has said in Landrum versus Chippenham Johnson Willis Hospital, you simply adhering to that standard is not enough. You have to go further if the defendant can show that there are other factors that the court should have considered, and or took a factor and didn't give it enough weight as it should. And that's, I think, what we're trying to convince this court that that's what happened. And the significant factor is the brother. The sister acknowledged that he was talking to my brother. She was walking away. The criminal complaint says that the statement was made to the brother. So when the judge says the brother was insisted it was made to her, it was flying in the face of the evidence that had come out prior to what the brother stated. And
but she, counsel, she was within earshot of that, and that's what the brother testified to, isn't it? Isn't that true? And ultimately, it becomes a credibility issue as to what the fact finder hears, perceives, and determines, and that's why we're here, because the fact finder determined. And of course, ultimately, you know what our standard is once the trial has occurred and the Commonwealth has prevailed. You understand
and even
the deference we're required to give.
Absolutely. And we think that this is one of those rare cases in which the court should look at it closely in terms of, again, it's the physical action of what happened. And it's clear in the transcript. The court made a choice. We give, of course, that discretion to make those choices. However, it has to be done within a context. And that's our argument, that she was walking away and he was making a statement to someone else. The statement he made to her was, come to the car. That's all he said. Now, whatever reason he said, whatever he's, the second part of this statement, he's saying it to somebody else. Next in the Supreme Court case that I put in our brief is basically the defendant was trying to argue that he wasn't talking to a child. He was talking to an undercover cop, undercover police officer. And the Supreme Court said, that doesn't matter. You still have to make the proposal to a person, and then you have to make it, you have to have the intent that you're making it to that kind of person. Just because as an undercover police officer, it doesn't matter. And so trying to piggyback on that argument, we're trying to say that that statement had to be made to her and not this sort of consolation of picking and choosing certain facts to fit a conviction ruling by the court. And the court acknowledged that in many ways in its argument at the end of the hearing, at the end of our statements. He was acknowledged that Jackson was talking to the brother in at least two of his examples. And we would argue that there was a series of other information and other motivations that could have happened at the time, which I think we pointed out to the court. And just simply choosing one without realizing the context, we would argue, was abuse of discretion, even under the high standards that this court demands. So at that point, Judge, I'll step back.
Thank you.
Good morning. And may it please the court, I'm Victoria Johnson, and I'm here for the Commonwealth. The defendant characterized his behavior on brief as creepy and uncouth. The Commonwealth certainly agrees with that. We also submit that it was felonious because his behavior clearly violated the indecent liberty statute. To start, Your Honors, just to clarify the standard of review, the defendant cited Landrum, which is an abuse of discretion case. This is a sufficiency case. This is a sufficiency challenge. Just to be completely clear, the question before the court is whether any reasonable fact finder, as the court previously stated, could find from this evidence the necessary elements. So with that kind of brief introduction, I'll just touch on a few things here. The evidence supports the trial court's finding that this individual made statements to this 12-year-old child, I think, at the time of the offense. This child opened the door, answered knocking on the door. This man said to her, "Are your parents here?" "No." "Why don't you come out to my car?" Or, "I want you to take a ride with me," or something to that effect. As the defendant has pointed out, there was a variation in the testimony between the little girl and her 18-year-old brother. The trial court, who was the trier of fact in this case, makes the determination between the variations in the testimony. Conflicts in the evidence, that's up to the trial court. The trial court chose. Actually, the trial court made alternative findings. The trial court said, right around appendix 119 to 121, right in that area, or pardon me, 113, the brother is insistent that the defendant's comment was directed to her. But even as a matter of common sense, a comment, as was mentioned in an earlier argument, can be directed to a third party, although it's spoken to someone else. Regardless, this child heard the comment, and it frightened her. That was her testimony. He said something to this little girl. She turned around and headed for her brother. She was some distance away as he was continuing to talk to her, or the brother testified, and there is evidence as to how loud these comments were. It's at appendix 78 to 79. The brother could hear what the defendant was saying from the living room over a movie that was playing on low volume on the TV. So the brother heard these comments, heard the beginning of the comments, and headed over. The brother testified that he heard the "sit on my face" comment and started moving fast. He said, "I heard him say it, you know, I come unglued." That's at 79. "He got up off the couch pretty fast because he was coming for him." That's at appendix 86. Brandon said that he went to the door and his little sister got behind him. That was at 81 and 86. And then he told the defendant to leave. And the brother said that the defendant got out of there pretty quick, which seems like a real logical sequence of events. Now, the trial court said basically, and I'm kind of paraphrasing here, any way you cut this testimony, there's a violation of the statute. The brother's pretty insistent that he overheard the defendant say these words directly to the child. The child was said that she overheard the sit on my face comment from several feet away while her back was turned. As the trial court said at 119 to 121, the statute doesn't say look straight at her and ask, it says propose. And I've gone through the analyses as to why I think it was a proposal to her, not about her. And then he talks about the lunch invitation thing. And then the judge talks about subsection 5 of the statute that talks about inviting into a vehicle or any other place for this improper sexual purpose. And he says, he shows up the door and says, hey, where are your parents? They're not at home. Oh, hey, come on, come get in my truck, in my vehicle. And at that point, that solicitation is a separate freestanding violation of the statute, which I point out to the court is not challenged in the assignment of error. If it is with the intent to achieve one of those purposes stated in the statute, and we know that what his intent was because he told us, because either directed to the brother within earshot of the sister or directly to the sister, and remember the trial court was there as a judge of credibility and was looking at this child, and you tell if the child was nervous and scared and was just so traumatized by this whole thing that she couldn't remember exactly what had happened, or she's just so embarrassed and aghast by the whole thing that she was having a hard time talking about it. But we know what his intent was because he told us. I think either way, Kamos made out his case beyond a reasonable doubt, and I will find him guilty as charged in the statute. And I submit that there is just sufficient evidence on this record. The defendant is relying on the Hicks case. I submit that doesn't really help the defendant very much. I think at best, the defendant may be making the same factual impossibility argument in a way that was made in Hicks. In Hicks, the defendant thought he was chatting with a 13-year-old. It was really an undercover police officer. Here, the defendant was trying real hard to proposition this child, but even under the defendant's set of facts, the child turned around and ran away. So if his plan had proceeded exactly how he wanted it to, he would have propositioned this child. He was only foiled by a factual circumstance beyond his control. That's factual impossibility.
But if the trial court believed the brother, he wasn't foiled at all.
Right, exactly. And the trial court did. The trial court credited the brother's testimony at Appendix 113. The trial court also said, even if he was talking to the brother, it was directed at the little girl. And besides, he asked her in the car. We know why he asked her into the car, because he told us. I submit the evidence is sufficient. This court should affirm. If there's questions, I'm happy to answer them. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And here are some of the problems that we have, in which the Commonwealth characterizes the evidence based on the transcript. That the child was scared, terrified, ran away. Those are not in the transcript.
Do you agree that the transcript reveals that the brother testified that he heard the comment made directly to his sister?
He testifies to that. That's
okay.
Correct.
If the trial court believes that, isn't that the end of the day?
If that was the only testimony, I would agree with you.
Well, wait a minute. The trial court can believe or disbelieve any bits and pieces
of testimony.
So if it believes the brother's testimony, isn't that a violation of the statute?
Yes. The problem here is what the sister said. There was no evidence that she was under any kind of...
If the sister had stood up and said, I wasn't even there, my brother's making the whole story up.
It would have been something the court would have to have
here. Would have to have considered, but if the court still said, I believe the brother, it's a violation of the statute.
And that would be, that if this court is saying that trial courts can simply take one piece of evidence and simply ignore it, even if it's in the Commonwealth's own case.
Well, we ask fact finders to do that all the time. You have conflicting pieces of evidence, you have to pick one.
It makes more sense if the defense puts on evidence and the Commonwealth puts on evidence and the defense and the court said, I don't believe the defense has offered. But we're talking about the Commonwealth's own case, and it's a variation with their own evidence. Now, the Commonwealth, the court, in essence, is now injecting itself into a Commonwealth case. It's saying, the Commonwealth present this evidence, and I'm just going to accept that part, but not this part. It makes more the court, Judge Russell, you make a lot of sense if it's opposite sides.
It's rare, but it happens.
But it, in this sense, and that's why it's rare, because it's just strange that a court would simply look at the Commonwealth and choose which part of the Commonwealth's evidence it's going to accept. I would urge the court to look at it more in a broad base and see that what the sister was saying is what happened, as opposed to what he is saying, because she does say that Jackson is talking to him, and that's in the transcript as well. The brother acknowledged, and the court does acknowledge that as well, when he's making his arguments. He's saying that, for the most part, his final rulings were talking about if there's a face-to-face, that if Jackson is talking to the brother, then these are the things that I can rule on. The last thing I'd like to say is that the Commonwealth does point out that, and I thought this was the more difficult argument for us to argue, was that he had made a proposal to the child, Jackson that is, and then the court can infer based on what he says to the brother what he wanted to do. And we're arguing that that's just speculation and on the course of finding a way to find the defendant guilty in spite of all the other evidence. It's not likely that he is going to say this to her brother under the circumstances. If he said that to a friend, if he had said that to somebody else, that would be something different. But not to her brother. This is what I want to happen. It is more likely that it was a Snyder Mark commentary. Now, that's a factual issue. The court made its decision. But there were other circumstances that surrounded it. And again, we rely on the fact that this particular case, we believe, is more physical than really anything else. The proposal has to be made to a person, and you think you're making it to that particular person. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll come down and greet counsel.